你要喝玫瑰？
Yes, ma'am.
Do y'all have any questions in specific about the content that was covered this week, either the cancer renal stuff?
I don't. I'm still trying to get through all of it right now and kind of figure out what I do and don't know.
Okay. What about you? Is it Shakaja or Shakaja?
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Oh, I didn't know this mic worked. Okay. No, I don't have any questions as of now. I'm still going through the material as well.
Okay. What about you, Brianna?
As far as like the burns, as far as detail as election and stuff, we need to know, I know we need to know it, but like the percentage, we have to calculate anything like dealing with like the percentage of burn surface and all of that.
No, you're not gonna have anything calculation wise, but you know, that was Ms. But you won't have anything calculation wise to calculate because y'all didn't have paper. So
okay.
I see. So I'm gonna pull Let's see. Just pull up.
Do you know when we'll receive our grades from our dosage exam?
We are going through the videos currently right now. So we're in the process of watching the So I would say probably Monday.
Thank you.
Computer is being super slow. So on the office hour from Wednesday, I kind of talked a little through the cancer and all of that immunity stuff. So I'm gonna pick up on renal today and just kind of talk through some of the key points for it. I think I may have left off talking about
For the cancer, do we need to focus on the treatments, what we do as nurses, or the etiology of it?
The treatments, just what we do as nurses. That's about it. Hold on just a second. All right, so I think I might have stopped off talking about obstructions. Yeah, I think I might have stopped off by talking about obstructions, but I'll keep it right here. So pretty much with obstructions, we want to worry about because the kidney has like this very, very low pressure system within it. So if there's any type of obstruction, of course, that will obstruct the urine from being able to exit from out the kidneys, which will lead to the kidneys failing if it's not corrected properly. So that's just something to kind of think about. We actually had a clinical because I had clinical yesterday. We had a patient, yes, you will need to upload practice A and B in Canvas. I'll make note that I need to open up those drop boxes for it. I thought I did though, but I'll make sure. But anyway, so she came in because she was having a kind of joint pain, and she ended up falling from having so much pain, and come to find out she had pyelonephritis. So she had inflammation of the kidney, but it was due to her ureter. One of her ureters was tied during the birth, so it was kind of clotted off. So they had to go in and do a stent in her ureter. But because of that, that blockage had been there for a while, she ended up getting an infection and then septic and was progressing into septic shock due to that infection. So that's just an example of how bad those obstructions can be. In the case where someone has to have a procedure to divert the urine, that is an instance, and there are different options. So we usually see this commonly with patients that have cancer, though, with those urinary diversions. But pretty much, they'll create a different way for them for their urine to come out. So I put some pictures in there, and I definitely want you to focus on the picture that's on slide 14. Because it shows you the different, the three main types of urinary divergent, the different types. So that ileal conduit one, and I'll share my screen and show you that. Can y'all see my screen? Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
So with the ileal conduit, as you can see, they pretty much, with all of them, they're going to create, that diversion with part of their intestine. So that's how they'll connect it. But with this ileal conduit, this one is an incontinent diversion. So with it being incontinent, that means they have no control over it. So what are some educational things you need to focus on with this one since they're incontinent with that one?
Protection of the skin?
Definitely protection of the skin. So we would treat it, they should treat this exactly how a patient with a colostomy bag would. You know, because the bag has to have a good seal on it. You got to make sure that you're cleaning the area good, watching for skin breakdown. So all those are some things that you want to make sure that you're educating your patient on when it comes to that one. So with it being an incontinent one, they are going to require to be, they're required to have like a bag over it because they have no control of it. This one is going to leak on its own. Now the second one, that's your continent one, the cutaneous reservoir. So with this one, how does this one work with the cutaneous reservoir one? Does anybody know how this one works?
Is that the one that they have to self-cath every 4 to 6 hours?
Yes, they have to self-cath every 4 to 6 hours. And that's so that they can kind of set themselves up on a bladder training schedule. So they would have to self-cath with that one. With this one, it's continent, so they don't have to worry about, you know, it leaking all the time. And so we also want them to, they don't have to have it covered, but it can leak a little bit of mucus. So sometimes they may want to put like a bandage over it, but that's how that one will work. And then the last one, which is your orthotopic meal bladder. So pretty much this is a newly created bladder for the patient. So not all patients can get this type of diversion. So what patients would not qualify for that type of procedure? This will be someone that's obese or if they have IBS, so irritable bowel syndrome. You definitely don't want to do it, you know, because it's created from out of the intestine. So if they have that disease, that's not, they're not going to be able to create a good bladder from. I don't know if y'all know, but Deion Sanders actually had this type of procedure done recently because he was diagnosed with bladder cancer. So they created him a brand new bladder. Y'all know who Deion Sanders is, right?
Of course.
Look, I got some folks in my face didn't know who he was. But anyways, I just had to ask. Another form of treatment for and this is just for a temporary basis, they're not going to do this, patients don't keep these in for long periods of time, is a nephrostomy tube. So it works the same way a Foley catheter does. Only thing, your nephrostomy tubes are placed directly in the kidney. So, of course, it's a line, it's invasive, so there are going to be risks and complications with it. So, let's talk about some of them. So, What are some things you think you would need to educate your patient on when it comes to nephrostomy?
Hygiene.
Definitely hygiene. Keeping it clean. Because it's in that low pressure area in the directly in that renal pelvis within the kidneys. What's the same thing we check for with Foley catheters to make sure that the tumor has no what?
Kinks in it.
No kinks. Because especially with that low pressure, it can cause that kidney to collapse. Those little renal pelvises can collapse, and that'll end up leading to that kidney failing. So no kinks. And it's so weird, y'all, because it seems like every time I lecture on some, my students get to see it. Last week we had, well, one of the students was in the ER, and a lady came in for a nephrostomy. Her tube was hanging out because a dog popped up on her and yanked it. So she ended up having to go to IR and have it re-put in, but big infection risk because the dog being near it. But same process with the nephrostomy is similar to a Foley catheter. So making sure that it's below. It needs to be below the level of the bladder to help with gravity. Making sure there's no kinks in there. And then sometimes patients can develop that sediment around, and we can, the physician put in an order for it to be flushed, but you're not going to flush with a large amount with those tubes because the line is so thin. So we don't flush with no more than 5 mL for those, if that order is placed. Let's see. So with AKI, have y'all gotten to see patients in the ICU with AKI yet? So with AKI, this is usually one of the first instances before they go into failure. So this is in the time they've had something that led to the kidneys not being able to be perfused properly, resulting in it's not being able to do its job. So can't filter, can't excrete, can't do anything. The buildup of toxins. So all of that can, that's what happens with AKI. But there are different types of causes. So this picture was the perfect picture because it kind of lets you know what's going on and where, and why is it labeled as the pre-intra post. So we know pre is before, right? So who can give us some examples of pre-renal causes of AKI? If it's pre, if it's before it makes it to the kidneys, what are some things that can lead to
high blood pressure, hypertension.
So with hypertension, not so much with hypertension. What about hypotension? Hypotension, because decreased volume, not getting enough blood flow to the kidney. So hypotension, and hypotension can be a result of hypovolemia. And hypovolemia is just where dehydration, not enough volume circulating. That table of 51.2 gives you examples of different things that will be pre-renal. So pre is anything that happens beforehand. If the heart starts failing, patient going into shock, all of those are things that's before. Now, intra means direct damage to the kidneys. So something has happened within the kidneys that's causing AKI. So this is where you actually have damage to the parenchyma, which is your tissue, your kidney tissue. So give me an example of a common antibiotic that is very nephrotoxic to the kidneys.
Is it Vanc?
Vanc is very nephrotoxic. That's why we have to be very careful with it. That's why we have to draw Vanc trials and check the lab for it, because it is bad on the kidneys. It is one of those medications that can cause what's called ATN, acute tubular necrosis. And that's just where the tubules inside of the kidneys, they end up becoming necrotic because of the decrease in the blood flow to it. Post is after, right? Post is something that's past the kidneys. So this is where we look at different obstructions. So this is like your stones and BPH in men, tumors, prostate cancer, things like that. So post is afterwards. So like, for example, the lady I was telling y'all about, we had that had hydronephrosis, where her ureter wasn't draining out the urine. That's past the kidneys. So that was a post renal thing that led to her developing AKI. So with the different phases of AKI, you have two phases that are completely different from each other. So that first phase, that oliguric phase. So with them being oliguric, what does oliguria mean?
Not urinating.
They're not urinating, not enough to keep going. So they have decreased urinary output. So just think about it, you know. They have decreased urinary output. What is this going to happen? Some things are going to happen with the electrolytes. And we know that with the Ra system within the kidneys, potassium is one of those electrolytes that are excreted during the filtering process. So if they're not peeing, the potassium levels are going up within the kidneys. And so that's going to lead to more potassium being in the blood than where it's supposed to. We're gonna have low amounts of sodium. So that's what you're gonna see in the oliguric phase. You're gonna see high amounts of potassium and low amounts of sodium during that specific phase. Why do y'all think they're in metabolic acidosis during the oliguric phase? What happens with metabolic acidosis? It's a buildup of what? We got a buildup of acids in the body other than that carbonic acid. So too much acid can't be filtered out because the kidneys aren't working. Kidneys aren't peeing. So during the oliguric phase, that's what's going on. Then you have your next phase, which is going to be the diuretic phase, the diuretic phase. So now we're in the opposite phase. Oliguric, I wasn't peeing, but now during the diuretic, what's going on?
Going too much
now, but now that I'm going too much, the urine is not concentrated. It's not concentrated. So I'm losing more volume during this phase. So with me losing all that volume, my body's being at risk for my blood pressure dropping, because I don't have the volume to do so because I'm peeing all of it out. So that's what you need to make sure you're being careful with and watching any blood pressure changes, especially during that phase. And then your recovery phase, which is your easy phase, that just lets you know that the bulimic feeling is going to start to normalize at this point. So patients with AKI, why do you think MRIs are contraindicated?
Kidneys are already affecting, you don't want to get them to die?
Yep, because the dye is one of those nephrotoxic things. Contrast dye is nephrotoxic to the kidneys. We also had a patient that he developed AKI because he had to keep going down for CT scans with contrast, and it caused contrast, what was it called? Contrast nephropathy. Yeah, contrast nephropathy. Which ended up causing damage to his kidneys because he had to have those wounds. So if you've ever wondered, because I know as far as general, any patients that's on metformin, they hold the metformin while they're in the hospital because metformin is one of those medications that will have a counter effect with contrast dye. So with dialysis, let's talk a little bit about dialysis, peritoneal dialysis. So peritoneal dialysis, have y'all ever taken care of a patient with peritoneal dialysis that has done peritoneal dialysis before?
No.
So this is where they do dialysis, and they can do it at home. We have patients that do their own PD treatments at home. So instead of going to get hooked up to a machine, having their blood circulated through that machine, through hemodialysis, they do peritoneal, where they actually dialyze in their abdominal cavity. So these patients, they're going to have like a catheter that they can hook up to, and they're going to fill their abdomen with their diastolate. And so that diastolate is, once they fill themselves up with it, they cap off the catheter, and then the whole dialysis process is going to take place in their abdomen. So all of the exchange, because what that diastolate is dextrose. So it's going to help with that filtering and pulling excess fluid off. So they leave it in. Some patients like to do it where they fill themselves up at night and then they go to sleep. And then when they wake up in the morning, they'll drain the diastolate off. So there are things to consider when taking care of or educating patients on this. They're gonna have this invasive line in their abdomen. So what's some things we need to make sure that we're educating them on? What about infection? They start getting redness around the area where their catheter is. Whenever they're draining that fluid off, that drainage should be clear. What if their drainage starts to be cloudy? That would be a sign of infection. And so something that they're at risk for developing is what's called peritonitis. So that's why we need to make sure that they are making sure they're doing hand hygiene, that they're being very sterile whenever they're hooking up their diastolate, and when they're filling in their emptying their diastolate off of their abdomen, because all of that is open. So they just need to make sure that they're aware of that. Y'all ever saw a patient with a fistula before?
Yes.
So So what type of assessments do we do on fishers?
The thrill and brew.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to feel the thrill and we're going to hear the brewing. So you listen for the brew with your stethoscope and feel the thrill. So it's, you should hear like a intense whooshing sound. You should also feel the same thing. So what do we know education-wise for that? And those patients with fistulas, they're very good about making sure you know what not to do with that arm that has a fistula in it. So what are some things we know we can't do?
Blood pressure.
No blood pressures, no sticks, no nothing on that side. Because again, we don't want to damage that that fistula because that's their access for receiving dialysis treatments. Another form of access is going to be what they call the pointing catheter. It's almost like a central line, but it's got the two lumens for to take the blood out and return the blood. And so this is also a temporary access. We treat it the same way we do a central line. So again, making sure dressing changes are sterile and making sure that those lines aren't just hanging around and hanging out and that they're capping anything because that is going to the heart. So with dialysis, what are some things that we're going to assess? So fluid status is going to be very important with hemodialysis. So tell me about the things we want to assess and how often, when do we want to assess them?
Pre and post?
Pre, actually pre, during, and post, because blood pressure is something we're going to want to make sure that we're continuously watching because again, we're taking out their, you know, we're taking their blood out the body. So that can make them hemodynamically unstable, but definitely pre. So what are some of the things that we're going to be assessing pre? They're coming for dialysis because their kidneys aren't working. And so the purpose of the machine is to filter out different things, pull off excess fluid because their kidneys can no longer do so. So we're assessing fluid status. Definitely want to make sure we get a weight before because some of those patients, they're swollen. They have excess, the excess fluid on them. So we want to get a weight beforehand. And we want to get away afterwards, after the treatments. What about listening to heart and lung sound? Why are we doing it?
Potential fluid overload.
Definitely potential fluid overload. And sometimes the patient, they're going to come in overloaded. So if we listen beforehand, after the treatment, we can see if they're still overloaded. That way we'll be able to communicate with the physician to let them know, okay, well, the patient has done their three or four hour treatment and they still have fluid on their lungs, then you know the physician may be like, okay, well, let's put in an order for Lasix. Let's do this. So that lets them know. So those that's gonna be also important. What about assessing edema? We're gonna need to do that before and after, because again, all of that's gonna play a part with letting us know if that treatment did what it was supposed to do. And the continuous dialysis, this is what's done in the ICU. This is just where the patient is dialyzing over 24 hours continuously. And so we're definitely gonna see this happen with patients that aren't tolerating any of the treatments to try to help get the excess fluid out. So severe cases of AKI, they'll do this type of dialysis in the ICU where it's running 24/7. Anybody have any questions? I did go in ATI and created y'all some practice assessments for the content that was the, not the content. That content that was covered last week and this week, me and Ms. Lottwin and get those for y'all to utilize. Are they helpful?
Yeah, they are, to me, at least.
The question, I didn't realize your ATI. I thought the drop boxes were open for ATI practice. I mean, let's see. Okay. Does anybody have any questions about the Tennessee stuff? Next few weeks are going to be very, very busy for us. I think after this week, y'all might end up having a piece almost every week. Are y'all excited for piece of the show?
Kind of.
Sort of. Just trying to work around the work schedule with me, so
yeah,
I get what I asked for.
But just so you know, you have a heads up, you have to do 14 shifts, so
the next semester, do we have anything else to do other than preceptorship? Just, what is nursing form?
So that's where you're going to be doing your comp predictor. So you do a lot of ATI in the class. You'll take what's called the comp predictor before. I think you take two of them. You're going to take one before the term, like at the beginning of the term, and then you take one at the end. And so the comp predictor predicts your probability of passing intakes. So, like based off of whatever you make on that first one, you'll have like little ATI things that you'll have to do. It's pretty much an ATI in quiz class. Yeah. That's pretty much it, but that's it. We have bad and peace up to it.
Do we have paperwork to do in preceptorship?
Yes, but it's not like care plan paperwork. It's pretty much like you do have to do like goals for the week. So for whatever shift, so say for instance, you gotta work 4 shifts that week, you're gonna do like 2 goals a day for that shift. And that'll be like your pre-stuff. And then your post stuff is going to be, they do what's called a pace assessment. We just kind of talk about what you did every day on your shift. And then you write on those goals, like if your goals were met or not. And that's about it with the paperwork about what you're doing. It's a lot of paperwork on the forefront because you have to go meet your preceptor. They have to fill out a whole bunch of paperwork. Y'all have to do like a schedule. So it's a lot of stuff you have to sign in the beginning, the free stuff. But for your weekly paperwork, that's what you'll be doing. You have to set goals for your shifts and then doing like an evaluation, seeing what all you did on your shifts, and that's it.
Okay, thank you for your time.
No problem. If you have any questions about anything, just shoot us an email.
Okay, thank you.
Y'all enjoy y'all weekend.
You too. Have a good day.
All right. You too.